Hello, I'm Eric Corman, CEO of League of Education Voters and the parent of a 10th grader of the global majority in the public school system who is accessing special education services. In this podcast, we interview students, policymakers, partners, and thought leaders to spotlight education policies, research, and practices so that together we can create learning environments where every Washington student feels safe, supported, and a positive sense of belonging so that they can achieve academically and access the life they choose. Zaretta Hammond calls herself a former writing teacher turned equity freedom fighter. Her heart is forever with children and teachers in the classroom, not in an ivory tower, even if these days most of her students are new leaders and pre-service teachers. When she was in the classroom back in the day, Zaretta taught composition, specifically expository writing. That was where she started to understand how important literacy was to equity, and how neuroscience and culture should inform our instructional practice. Zaretta is a consultant who works with teachers, leaders, and instructional coaches. She's the author of Culturally Responsive Teaching and the Brain. Her new book, Rebuilding Students' Learning Power, Teaching for Instructional Equity and Cognitive Justice, will be published in September. Sign up for Zaretta's newsletter at crtandthebrain.com. Zaretta, what is culturally responsive teaching?
Well, it's great to be here on the podcast, and that is a great question to start with. And I think there's a lot of misconception about what it is, and a lot of focus is on the culture part of that versus the responsive and the teaching, right? And so a lot of people hear that and they associate it with anti-racist education or implicit bias training, really about kind of the legacy of race, racism, and, you know, social justice. But that would be a real misunderstanding about what culturally responsive teaching is. Those things are real, and a lot of people have dealt with them in the school district and, you know, around the country. But when we talk about culturally responsive teaching, we are more in the realm of neuroscience, social and cognitive neuroscience, than in the realm of talking about racism. Now, the reality is there is the element of using culture as a cognitive scaffold. So culturally responsive teaching is really a pedagogical approach to helping students use their knowledge and cultural assets, what they know, that could be one of those assets, could be their language as well, their mother tongue, or what they speak at home or in their community, to make information, the subject matter content being taught, more comprehensible. So making it not just relevant, but deepening students' conceptual understanding. So at the heart, that is really what culturally responsive teaching is. But the responsive part is the teacher's ability to kind of be the personal trainer of students' cognitive development. Now, why do we have culturally responsive teaching that highlights Black and brown children primarily? And that has to do with our legacy of segregation in our public schools. So it's not something that's only for them. Here's the reality. All instruction is culturally responsive. The question is, whose culture is it responding to? Mm-hmm. So the idea is you want to be able to have students kind of use their schema, right? And so culturally responsive teaching revolves around kind of three big ideas in neuroscience. One is that the brain has to be relaxed and alert in order to be ready for learning. So if there's psychological safety, that's great. If there's belonging, I'm in this relaxed state, my cortisol is low, and I'm ready for kind of the deep learning work. If the opposite is true, then the brain favors safety, getting you safe, being on alert, getting you out of danger, over learning. So again, that's why that belonging piece is so important. The second rule of the brain that it revolves around is this idea that you have to mix the new with the known, meaning new content. The only way the brain learns is by mixing and remixing whatever new thing you're learning with what you already know. Mm-hmm. It is not mixed with what you already know, the brain forgets it. So that idea of students, like, what do you already understand about this subject? Or if you've ever encountered this experience, you have to activate that prior knowledge. So this is back to schema. That is a key part of it. And the third rule is that the brain processes this information through talking and doing. What we see is this kind of active learning as students are getting into what we call that learning pit, the zone of proximal development, and that the teacher's role and that responsive role is to be the personal trainer of students' cognitive development. This is good for all students, and knowing your students so you understand what their schema is and you can actually create what I call those cognitive hooks, that's really at the core of what culturally responsive teaching is. And unfortunately, a lot of people have truncated it to social justice themes in the curriculum or more brown faces in books. That is not all of what culturally responsive teaching is. So this other neuroscience route is where we really get the power of it.
It sounds like it's really based on relationships.
I would disagree with that.
Really? Okay.
Yes, I would.
So the reason why I say that is for a teacher to understand what one of their students' schemas are, where they're coming from, what their superpowers are, knowing how much physical activity or movement needs to be done, kind of understanding like how they click, as it were. Doesn't that take time to get to know your student in that way, to be able to employ culturally responsive teaching?
I would, number one, say it's not necessarily predicated on movement. Learning by doing doesn't always mean movement. And the reason I'm lifting that up is that is a place where I believe we have a lot of misconceptions, particularly white progressive educators, right? So there are a few things I will hear continually when people talk about culturally responsive teaching. So one is to lead with, oh, it's about relationships. At its core, it's about information processing. How do I get to know that? You are absolutely right. I have to first understand what information processing is. I can see if I'm actually paying attention to the student, a lot of that information that you just talked about. I don't always have to have some deep relationship with them. Now, do I want their brain to be calm and ready? Yes, that's going to be predicated on creating an environment where there's psychological safety. When I do trainings around culturally responsive teaching, I don't lead with relationship. That is through, right? That's a pass through. But what I usually hear when people, particularly if there's been a strong focus on social justice in a district or in a region, is this relational piece. And I really think this is where we kind of go off into what DeFore calls a dangerous detour, right? It's good because you can have a wonderful relationship and still not really understand anything about information processing, collectivist culture, and those learning tools, and how those learning tools actually help process that information. So it's not just random facts and figures, but usable knowledge. Like if the teacher hasn't mastered that and understand who the students are coming in, not just one-on-one, so that, oh, I got to build a relationship with 30 kids and I've got 19 different cultures in my classroom. Well, the teacher immediately is overwhelmed.
Yeah.
I can't do that. So I don't lead with that. And so I think it helps people understand like, oh, I'm really trying to understand students that do come from a particular cultural background. Here are the cultural learning tools. Here is how learning is set up at home. I don't need to have a relationship with you initially to understand that. That group of kids and that community has been representative in that district for the last decade.
So there are schema that you can pull from that will give you the information you need in order to effectively employ culturally responsive teaching then.
And what I would say is any district that is doing equity and making sure that they are focused on every student being a powerful learner will have already banked that information. They're not waiting to try and tease it out of the student. That just doesn't seem to be part of continuous improvement. It's like if my school is made up of South Asian students, African American students, Asian students, and white students, then I pretty much can start to understand what might be the breadth of cultural expressions of learning. And then I can just start to employ those, and the brain starts to recognize them. And then imagine the calmness when the student's like, oh, I already know how to do that, or I already have schema. So the teacher isn't trying to always do this investigation.
That sounds like that saves a lot of time and a lot of energy for everyone. So when you're employing this, what does that look like? How does it support students within the classroom? Obviously, they're calmer. They see an on-ramp to learning because it's material that they have some familiarity with that we're just building on. But what are some of the other benefits?
Well, the benefit is the student actually can lead with intellectual curiosity. That's the word I'd love to use, right? This idea that we leverage students' curiosity, and the more the teacher understands the on-ramp to information processing, the more they're able to get the student to actually pay attention to their learning moves. Because again, the idea isn't that this is just something the teacher does. It's not a gimmick. It's not a set of strategies. It is an approach in which the dispositions and the skills that the student brings, the teacher is coaching the student around that. So what it would look like is, what do the first 5 minutes look like? Students connecting with each other. So rather than we're having morning meeting or we're sitting in a circle, it should really be a simulation, right? Or maybe they're playing games that are related to the content, right? So I call this the hide the vegetables approach. It should not be so evident that I've be even saying the words culturally responsive. It's just the students come in because in collectivist culture, that's what you're doing. The first few minutes of anything is going to be a social connection, but that social connection is around the task at hand. So a lot of times what I see is, oh, we're doing SEL and we think it's about belonging relationships, and then we don't carry that close to cognition and the learning episode, where we help the students regulate emotions or leverage the distributed expertise of the class. So that first 5-10 minutes, the teacher can totally revamp. So it's not just I'm putting the do now on the board and then have students do whatever it is while I take attendance, and then we're going to have morning meeting. Like, it's a little more integrated, following the science of learning, because in collectivist cultures, that's actually what you're doing.
That is revolutionary in a way, because so many classrooms I've seen is that they'll do their morning meeting to do the morning meeting, you know, check the box, but there isn't the so what component of it necessarily. It doesn't necessarily lead into something else.
That's right. So in a culturally responsive classroom, things are integrated and they do lead to something else. And the student eventually knows that I'm not just coming into a classroom, I'm coming into a cognitive dojo. So in collectivist culture, learning is centered around kind of a cognitive apprenticeship, right? And that is not true in most of our classrooms. It's still the teacher is a primary thinker, right? Still carrying the cognitive load. We don't have kind of the structures that allow students to leverage their distributed expertise from each other. It's a turn and talk, which is too weak, not effective enough. The other thing it would look like is good feedback loops, right? How does the student actually know that their learning moves are being translated into moving in the right direction, right? Building their learning power, learning from their mistakes. So in a culturally responsive classroom, there'd be a culture of errors, meaning mistakes are viewed as information, and there are time and structures to actually talk about those mistakes. And then how we orient and socialize students versus a pedagogy of compliance, which again can look very active, could look very friendly, but it is not designed to actually help students become more powerful learners. It's actually designed to socialize them to be quiet, look busy. And then we see this with a lot of schools, right? Then they get to their year-end data and it's like same kids at the bottom, same kids at the top.
And does this approach, the culturally responsive teaching approach, work for all grades? In other words, I can see sharing expertise when the kids are maybe a little bit older, but what would that look like with the younger kids in, say, K through two?
I think so, because I think that's a misnomer that we don't want to promote. Maria Montessori knew it from the beginning. So if you look at a Montessori classroom, that's a culturally responsive classroom. Why? Because they are leveraging the expertise of children as young as 3, 4, 5. Mm-hmm. How? Because they talk to each other. What are you seeing as they're doing their investigations or their inquiry? This is why talk is centered. Expertise doesn't mean, oh, I know this and I've researched that. It means, here's what I understand. And, oh, somebody loves buttons. So now we're doing something involved. Oh, let's ask Larry over there who just loves buttons. So now we can tap Larry's expertise that the group sees. It has all these rich resources. So I don't want to promote this idea that culturally responsive teaching is separate from regular teaching. It is regular teaching. It is not an approach, quote unquote. That would be leading into kind of misconceptions about culturally responsive teaching. All instruction is culturally responsive. The question is, whose culture is it responding to?
Right. So in other words, this should be just school so that everyone does feel like they're part of it and that's not catering to just one specific culture.
And not just part of it, but that everyone is becoming a more powerful learner. Because for a long time, we already have people part of it. We have students who are feeling the sense of belonging. We've invested in SEL, belonging, and morning meetings. What we haven't invested in equally is building students' instructional power, building students' learning power, making sure that they're good information processors. That's where the historical piece of segregation in American schools is really evident, because we still see the ramifications of that. While no one is setting out to enact that, it's so embedded in our structure, the DNA of schooling. Joel Mehta out of Harvard Graduate School of Education calls it the grammar of schooling. Like, there's a way in which we do it that really just is this kind of compliance. And for certain children, they are going to get tracked. And not because people like, I'm going to track you. We now are inadvertently using things like reading. So let's look at who's reading and who's not. So at a certain point, no adult has to do anything. Because if you cannot have fluency with your sound spelling correspondences, we know pretty much after fourth grade, you're going to have a really hard time keeping up with the new content. Same thing with number sense. If there's no automaticity with number sense, division, multiplication, you're pretty much not going to get to algebra. And nobody has to say or do a thing. So this is back to equity. How is inequity enacted? By ensuring that those skills are developed. And how best to do that? This is where the science of learning comes in. So it's all connected. It's all connected.
Yeah. Wow. Let's talk about you for a moment here. How did you get to this realization in your own education journey? What worked for you and what didn't work so well for you?
My mother was a single parent. She had 3 kids by the time she was 22, but she had a passion for learning. And her parents were both illiterate, had come from the Deep South in Louisiana in search of less racism and more opportunity. They were illiterate all their lives. But my mother, you know, really saw education as an important thing and took it upon herself not just to put us in school, but to make sure that we read, that we became readers, that we learned to read. And she did not leave that up to the school district, because for a lot of Black and Brown students, when it's left, you know, parents bring their children and joyfully bring them there thinking school is going to do that for them, and it doesn't. And this is the inequity of it all, right? And so again, if we want to ensure equity, it's not just about belonging. It's just not about talking about it. It's about making sure that particular skills are developed. So that was what my mother did for me. She sent me to a predominantly white school. I got a wonderful education, met wonderful people. This is a year or two before our city, I grew up in San Francisco, was integrated. but I lived in the projects, predominantly African American and Samoan community, and I saw the disparity. So what worked for me was, you know, following my intellectual curiosity. What didn't work for me was the great push by a lot of teachers in that system to confine me to this pedagogy of compliance. And it was really difficult. I really think that's what helped me understand equity was important. Now, the way I got into culturally responsive teaching, because as a writing teacher, I wanted to make sure my students became powerful writers. And I started to see they were coming in, not reading on grade level, not really feeling confident as learners. And so I aimed to turn that around. So brought in the neuroscience, brought in culturally responsive practice, and they were able to create that dojo, that cognitive apprenticeship in which they started to see their own skill set, because that's what we were talking about, feedback loops, being metacognitive and metastrategic, so that they were building their own cognitive capacity. That was really the most powerful thing that I could do for them.
Well, if you were in charge of Washington State's education system, and I'm talking not just K-12, but early learning and post-secondary plus K-12, what would you do, especially if there were no budget constraints and you could wave a magic wand?
It sounds like a fun question, but it's so multi-layered in terms of what the right drivers are, mm-hmm. and at particular levels. Some are system-level things you need to do. Some are in the instructional core, which is in the classroom, and then the coherence and articulation between all of that. But I could say I would certainly ensure that within the instructional core in the classroom, every teacher understood that their job was to make sure students become powerful learners. So that begins with reading. So even if a teacher is in the eighth grade, they're not just teaching comprehension. If you see there are holes in the student's learning, that there's a system and a process at that middle school level to ensure that they get that. We supposedly have that, but it's not happening. We can just look at ninth grade and see that. The other thing I would do is to ensure that teachers get more professional learning, not just more PD hours, but that we reconfigure what that looks like. So summers should not be summers anymore. And it should be summers for students. I'm not talking about year-round school, but that teachers should be year-round employees. They shouldn't have to go get second jobs. They could still get a little vacation time. They should have more than 2 weeks. But the fact is, this is grand time for professional learning. And then all schools would be continuous improvement. We'd have a better pipeline from TK to kindergarten into the early grades, very Montessori style in which students are learning hands-on. We have a tendency to delay for too long some of those skills. We don't trust our youngest learners. And at the other end, certainly by 10th, 11th grade, these are young adults, and they should be having a more integrated experience, right? And so that they can pursue their intellectual curiosity around particular professions with the integration of the core skills they need to continue to develop. But by ninth grade, every student should be able to write a 10-page argumentative essay, right? Not from AI or ChatGPT. Yeah. On their own, right? It's coherent. And, you know, being able to do that so that they have the skills to kind of move into this next level of integrated real-life learning, place-based learning, learning in real industries in which it's not an internship, but this is how you learn your math, because this is where we do math in order to carry out this job or to get this result. I think some of that is missing. We delay that too long. So we need to think about key things we can do in our school system. And I think for Washington State in particular, there's a long history, a very, you know, noble history of social justice, implicit bias work. And, you know, it's time to kind of level that up and really start to look at the science of learning, understanding that the social justice task is to ensure every student is a reader and has number sense and automaticity versus just talking about racism in the classroom. Every student needs to understand history, American history, but if you are just talking about topics and you see the student is not reading on grade level, you're actually being an unwitting participant and collaborator in inequity by design.
Zaretta Hammond is a consultant who works with teachers, leaders, and instructional coaches. She's the author of Culturally Responsive Teaching in the Brain. Her new book, Rebuilding Students' Learning Power, Teaching for Instructional Equity and Cognitive Justice, will be published in September. Sign up for Zaretta's newsletter at crtandthebrain.com. Zaretta, thank you so much for joining me.
You are so welcome. This was fun.
Thanks so much for listening. If you'd like to learn more about League of Education Voters or support our work, please visit our website, educationvoters.org.